So thank you all for coming. The topic today is Eishes Torah of Aharon Lechassin, Rabbi Nachman of Breslov, and the source of faith. The basic point of today's shiur is that throughout the year at MMY, throughout our Jewish education, throughout learning, we always make certain basic assumptions, such as the existence of God, such as the historical narrative that God created the world in 6 days, God redeemed the Jewish people from Mitzrayim, and that God revealed Himself in Har Sinai and gave us the Torah. Generally speaking, those things are taken for granted, and we go on from there. Let's study Chumash, let's study Halakha, let's study what Hashem gave us, and understand the depth and the beauty and of it, and how to think about our lives and how to live our lives. But there's this whole other school, a whole other genre, a whole other topic within Jewish philosophy, which is trying to sort of question all that, go back to the basics, and figure out why do we believe what we believe? Why are those things the foundational assumptions of the rest of our Torah study? So we're not going to do justice to this topic today. Obviously, it's a very wide topic with lots of sources, lots of ideas, which really has to be split into two different questions. One is about the God question, the other one is the Jewish narrative question. We're sort of going to be fudging both of them over here. And there's a lot of literature, things I've read, things I haven't read on both. What I want to try to do is to focus on two different perspectives that currently exists in the Jewish Orthodox world as how to address these questions. We're not going to be giving full responses, full answers, but two very general ways, very different ways, not mutually exclusive, but rather complementary, that in different schools of thought, different people, different thinkers address these questions. And just from the outset, there are other people who address them differently. Rabbi Jonathan Sacks does a great job of addressing some of these questions in some of his books. A Letter in the Scroll, Radical Then, which is the same book, is called Radical Then, Radical Now, The Great Partnership. Rav Shagar has essays about this. There's this person, Rabbi Shai Held, who I recently listened to a lecture of his. And it's called Why I Believe in God Sometimes. It's up on YouTube. He's not orthodox. I don't think he's fully orthodox, but he certainly cares a lot about Judaism. Very educated, very articulate. Also has a very, very, I thought very eloquent approach to this question. The two figures I wanted to touch on in the contemporary Jewish scene are Eishes Torah or Sameach, that school of thought, and I'm going to be lumping together into a certain mold, and something Rav Aharon Lichtenstein wrote maybe two decades ago. On looking at the question from a very different vantage point. So let's look at our first source. Our first source is from Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb. I'm sort of using him as an exemplar, as a paradigm for this approach. Anybody hear any lectures or shiurim from Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb? He teaches in Or Sameach and Eish. He has YouTube videos up. He is an interesting person. He is much more educated than I am. He grew up, I think, a Reform Jew in America. He got a PhD, I think, in philosophy, or maybe some cross between science and philosophy, somewhere or other. He taught general philosophy at Johns Hopkins. Over the course of his life, he moved in the direction of Frumkeit, became a Baal Tshuva. Now he's a senior lecturer at Or Sameach and Eishes Torah, which cater to lots of populations, but are mainly known as Baal Tshuva institutions. So this is a book he wrote called Living Up to the Truth. Just to note, it's not really a book he wrote. It's really a transcript of lectures. So it's going to sound, he has a PhD, he can obviously write English very well, but it's going to sound much looser because it's a transcript of various lectures he gave. I think it was published in a book, and it's free online at Or Sameach's website. Living Up to the Truth, what the book says it's going to do is try to explain to you, the listener, from or not from, why out of all the millions or thousands of narratives that exist out there, why the Orthodox Jewish narrative is the most compelling one. But we believe it's God revealed himself at Sinai and gave us the Torah. Muslims believe that, the Christians believe that, the Hindus don't believe that, the atheists don't believe that. There are many people in the East who have never heard of this until many thousands of years after the Bible was written and things started spreading. Why do we think our narrative is the correct narrative? So before he starts tackling the question, he tries to figure out what is the best way of approaching this question. This is a very fundamental question, a very broad question. You need a methodology. So he wants us, these are excerpts from the book. So he wants to read. So then the question should be, does anybody want to read? Please, thank you.
So the question
is,
how should we look for truth? How should we pursue it? And if we are looking for the truth and we are to be objective and open-minded, shouldn't we give equal time to all the candidates? Shouldn't we take time to familiarize ourselves with not only Judaism, but also Christianity, Islam, Buddhism, into his Taoism and
Confucianism and Shintoism.
Just to mention the major world religions.
Wait, all the topics are the finals here, right? Comparative religion. That's in the next semester.
That's so to become thoroughly familiar with the inner workings of a religion, as I am sure you know, is not a trivial matter. Even with 6 months for each religion, which is probably too short, you're talking about a 4-year investigation. Most people don't have the time. Well, I hope to show you on a general intellectual grounds that we can be objective and open-minded and yet drastically reduce the scope of this investigation.
Right, so what would the best, according to him, what would the best approach be if you had infinite time and infinite resources and you didn't have to work for a living?
Check
everything out. Like, do full research, fully ensconce yourself within different environments, different cultures, different ideologies, and think about it. Most of us don't have the time, the wherewithal, the ability to do that because we're busy, we're finite, we're interested in other things, we have other responsibilities. So what should we do then? Let's continue, please.
The method of searching for truth, in my view, is the scientific method. It is the only method which we have. With all its limitations and all its weaknesses, it is the only neutral method we have in searching for the truth. The trouble is, the scientific method is very poorly understood.
Let's stop over there. So what is general methodology? What would this be if you went around to all the cultures in the world and studied them and thought about it afterwards? This would be what he calls the scientific method. You're evaluating evidence. Good. If you want to know what the best economic policy is, let's say you want to know which candidate to vote for, and one candidate says we should give a lot of money to the rich people. If we give money to the rich people, then they're going to create businesses and that's going to create jobs. Another candidate says no, then the poor people are not going to have any money. Let's give the money directly to the poor people. And the first people say, but no, if you give the money directly to the poor people, they're not going to have jobs. They're just going to get handouts, and it's not going to be sustainable. This goes back and forth, back and forth, back and forth. So what would the best way to resolve that question be? If you're doing it scientifically, so to speak. Look at evidence. Look at studies. Which society has tried Model A in the past? Which society has tried Model B in the past? See which one works. It's very hard to do in real life because there's so many other variables other than the pure economic models that are there. But that would be the best way to do it. Similarly with religions, the best way to choose your religion, the best way to choose your narrative, the best way to choose your ideology would be to study everything and evaluate the evidence, see which one is the most plausible. We don't have time to do that, so let's look at a shortcut of how to apply the scientific method in a shorthand fashion. Does somebody else want to read the first element, next beginning of the next paragraph? Oh, please, thank you.
Method of searching for truth?
Yeah, the next paragraph after that, the first element.
The first element of the scientific method is that for an idea to be taken seriously as true, there must be positive evidence of its truth. Whoever offers an idea and claims that it is true must present positive evidence of its truth. That sounds obvious to you, consider the following. I want you to meet Uncle Paddy from Northern Ireland who believes in leprechauns. I asked him once, Uncle Paddy, do you really believe in leprechauns? Little green men who scurry behind the furniture and to beat up the crumbs they leave on the dining room table at night? And he said, yes, absolutely, I believe in leprechauns. So I said to him, Uncle Paddy, do you have any evidence for leprechauns? Did you ever see any? Did you set up a high-speed camera and catch them in flight? Did you ever find wee little footprints in the dust? He said that he had no evidence whatsoever. So I said to him, then why do you believe in them if you have no evidence? If I'm looking for truth, if I'm trying to fulfill my responsibility to find the truth, I need a reason for my selection.
Good. And the point is that you can come up with any type of ideology, and in theory, it would be a good idea for the objective observer to analyze everything, study everything, and weigh all the information. But unless something has a foot off the ground, unless something seems plausible, unless something seems like it makes sense, there's no reason, there's not necessarily a reason to study it, there's no reason to assume its truth. I could assert the existence of unicorns, and nobody in this room would be able to disprove me. But it doesn't necessarily mean that it's a good use of your time to try to go around the world and look at every single nook and cranny, put up cameras in every place in the world, and try to disprove the fact that I happen to think unicorns exist. I almost do, but whatever. I used to. So he's basically trying to whittle out his ideologies. There are tons of ideologies out there in the world. Let's start focusing on the ones that seem plausible. Let's start focusing on the ones that to us, as human beings, as Westerners, whatever it is, in our mindset, seems like it has some positive evidence in that direction. Good. So he whittles away a little bit. Now let's start the next section. This is from the middle of the book. It's all one PDF. So if you download it, you could just search it. Now he's going to start to actually review the evidence. He's going to give you some cautionary remarks before he actually gets into the evidence. And then we'll look at his summary of the evidence at the end. So here are his cautionary remarks in terms of weighing the evidence, in terms of what type of evidence should we be looking for to see if a religion or a narrative or an ideology is true. Who wants to start? Now we'll begin in a review of the evidence. Suzanne, please.
I will start with two cautionary remarks. First, when I present evidence, the significance of the evidence is that it makes it probable that the Torah being true. To respond that it is still conceivable that the Torah is false is quite correct, but irrelevant. The goal is not to remove every conceivable alternative. It is to present that the Judaism is as a more probable alternative.
Right, so if you have a question in science and you have a theory that is the most plausible theory, that becomes the working theory from which to work off. So we're not looking for 1,000% hard rock evidence. If we're looking at things scientifically, we're looking for the most plausible narrative. Good. Point B.
Second, we are now gathering evidence. To gather evidence means no one piece of evidence need carry the case by itself. This is similar to a courtroom procedure. If you want to convict a murderer, just find his fingerprints at the scene of the crime isn't enough. Just finding a weapon similar to the one that caused the murder in his house is not enough. Just having a motivation is not enough. Just him having been seen at the place of the murder at the time of the murder is not enough. But when you put them all together, it can be enough. So again, it is not relevant. It will not be relevant to respond that this piece of evidence is not enough to justify believing the Torah is true. Of course it isn't. No one piece of evidence is enough. It is all the evidence together which is enough. We won't begin to sum up all the evidence until the last chapter.
Let's stop over there. So what's his second argument? We're looking for positive pieces of evidence. That was his first point. His second point is we're not looking to create an objective 100% case. We're looking for the most plausible narrative. And what is the best way to create the most plausible narrative? Putting together multiple pieces of evidence. No single proof is going to carry the day by itself. But put together various points, you're going to be able to show or demonstrate that this narrative, the Orthodox Jewish narrative, is the most plausible narrative of everything else that is out there. Good. Most of the book that's all his methodology. Most of the book actually goes through the pieces of evidence one by one. He calls it the Martian test. If you had a Martian looking down from space, the Martian knows nothing about human civilization, comes down from space and looks at different societies, different ideologies, different philosophies, which one would they think is the most plausible? Which one would they think is the most likely to actually be true, to actually have occurred? So at the end of the book, he sums up the evidence as follows. Who wants to read? Then this is the key point for us, or sort of the key point. Tanya, please.
It seems to me that the survey of the features of Jewish history that I presented would lead the Martian to conclude that the Jew is utterly unique. First, the Jew possesses predictions of events that could not have been expected to happen, and on which a neutral bystander would have put a very low probability.
So stop over there. What events do you think he's referring to? He develops this at length in the book. Which events are predicted in Chumash that he thinks have occurred? Predicted in ancient times?
Mass genocide.
Mass genocide in what sense? That.
In every generation, people rise up to kill us.
Oh, okay, anti-Semitism. So I'm not sure if that's explicit. I guess it's there somewhere. I was looking more at a slightly broader narrative. Any ideas? Yeah.
Gathering of exile.
Yeah, he says it's something which we can only say now. The Ramban sort of predicts it going forward, but just read part of the end of Sefer Devarim, like Kisavo. There's this narrative there. The Jews are going to come into the land of Israel. They're going to live there for a time. They're going to sin. They're going to get kicked out. And at the end of history, they're going to come back. And out of all ancient prophecies, we have dozens of ancient prophecies from the same time period. This seems to be the only prophecy written 3,000 years ago that actually happened. Let's go on.
The estimate that we came up with in this essay is a possibility of 16,000, that the prediction in Devarim 28:30 would be expected to come true. And against all expectations, this prediction came true.
Right, so the events of Jewish history, as predicted by a book that predates the unfolding of those events, is not hard rock evidence. It could be, maybe Jews... The reason why Jews survived and came back to the land is because they believed this myth. Somebody convinced them that the history is going to unfold this way. They believed it, and therefore they decided to do it on their own. So there are counter-narratives. It's not hard rock, But it's intriguing. It certainly raises your curiosity that this is the only ancient prophecy of the entire ancient world that seems to have come true. Obviously, this is assuming somewhat of a Zionist narrative, that like the return of Am Yisrael to Eretz Yisrael is a positive thing, b'zman hazeh, and we're living in semi-prophetic times, we're actually fulfilling the nevuos by living here. It's not necessarily something that's agreed upon by all Jews, but it certainly seems to make sense if you read Chumash straight. Second, please, Taya.
Second, the Jew seems to have had in his history miraculous events, unique public miracles that other nations don't even claim. Very surprising unique events have happened in Jewish history, events which serve to support Judaism, to enable Judaism to survive, and to rescue Judaism from dangerous circumstances.
Good. So let's focus more on the first point. Unique public miracles and other nations' own claims. He's sort of mixing together various things. Who makes this argument that Jews have unique public miracles that other nations, other religions don't claim?
Huh?
Who else makes this argument? This is one of the medieval arguments for the authenticity of the Jewish narrative. This is from the Kuzari. The Kuzari points out, and the Kuzari was written by Rav Yehuda Levi. Rav Yehuda Levi was a Spanish poet, philosopher, politician, Talmid Chacham. He was a wide-ranging person. His most famous book is a Kuzari, which is a fictionist tale of, well, this one's not fictionist. There was a small country, a small group of people called the Khazars, who converted to Judaism en masse. So Rav Yehuda Levi knew about this story. It happened a couple centuries before him, if I recall correctly. And he wanted to write a book of Jewish philosophy, what he calls the Defense of the Persecuted Religion. So he basically created a narrative. He created a discussion between the king of the Khazars and various religions around the world, a Christian, a Muslim, a philosopher, and a Jewish Chacham. And he tells you a type of conversation that might have occurred. The king wants to leave paganism. He interviews the philosopher, the Christian, the Muslim, and the Jew. And the Jew is the one who's most convincing to him. He kicks out the other people pretty early on. Kicks out the philosopher pretty early on. The Christian is the next one to go. The Muslim is the next one to go. And then the Jew, the Chacham, basically has like this very long conversation with him. And in that book, one of his major arguments for the authenticity of the Jewish narrative is that the Judaism is the only religion that bases itself on a mass revelation. So how does Christianity start? Jesus does miracles to a group of people. Even Jesus' resurrection is not witnessed by a large amount of people. Muhammad's miracles are also only witnessed by a few people. What is the foundational myth, so to speak? Where does Am Yisrael's relationship with Hashem really start? Har Sinai, and that was a mass revelation. Everybody saw the miracles of Mitzrayim. It focuses more on everybody saw the divine revelation of Har Sinai. And therefore, it must be true. What's his argument, therefore it must be true? Exactly. That's what he claims. He claims that I could go around this room, if I'm charismatic and I'm spiritual and I have sleight of hand, I could convince people that I perform miracles. Perhaps. Or maybe 100 years after now, I could convince you, somebody could convince you that I perform miracles. But I can't convince a whole nation that all of their ancestors saw something if that's not part of anybody's family tradition. He says it's very unlikely for Shmuel, for somebody in the first temple period, second temple period, whatever it is, to go around Israel, go around the land of Israel, convincing people that all of their ancestors witnessed a certain event if there's no actual evidence, there's no family histories, family traditions that event took place. Is this foolproof?
No.
Maybe. Some people are find it super convincing, some people don't. Maybe it grew over time. Maybe there's a really charismatic person who convinced people of things. We have no idea what really happened in the ancient world. But again, it's for Rabbi Dr. Gottlieb, this is another very interesting, very semi-fully convincing, but another interesting piece of evidence that points in the direction of the authenticity of our narrative. What's the third piece of evidence? Third?
Third, Judaism survived and developed under historical conditions which were unique, conditions which would have led to the disintegration of Judaism, especially compared to Christianity.
Right, this is the third, it's similar to his first point, but here he's not focusing on the fulfillment of prophecy, he's focusing just on the existence of Am Yisrael. And this is something that regular historians point out also, that out of all nations that existed in the ancient world, Am Yisrael seems to be the only nation that was exiled and didn't assimilate into the majority population. they're no indigenous. Nobody who claims that they're Romans or Greeks in terms of the continuity of the ancient nation states. But there's a clear history of the continuity of Am Yisrael in different geographical locations all over the world, dating all the way back to Bayit Sheni, if not earlier. So the existence of Am Yisrael seems to be something unique in the annals of history. And it seems to be connected with this bris that Hashem made with the Jewish people, where God says that he's not going to forsake the Jewish people. And therefore, the existence of Am Yisrael right now, in the year 2019, does also seem to be a piece of evidence, a point in the direction, that whatever it says in Chumash is actually true. Good. So if you had to summarize Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb's approach to the question, how do you approach this question of religion? The same way you approach any other factual question. What's the best way to approach any factual question? Evidence. And where does the evidence lie, according to him? With the Orthodox Jewish narrative, for those reasons. Some of those reasons are his summary of medieval reasons, and some of them are unique to living in the 20th century or 21st century, back in the land of Israel. You want to see a picture of him? This is a picture of Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb on page number 3. If you're familiar with other books or other types of lecturers from this community, let's say the Esh HaTorah, the Or Sameach, I shouldn't lump them together, but those types of places, has anybody here read Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman's book, Permission to Believe, Permission to Receive? It's a very similar type of thing. We're looking at things objectively, we're looking at things rationally, we're looking at the evidence. The evidence is that God exists, creationism versus evolutionism, whatever it is, and that's his first book, Permission to Believe. The second book, Permission to Receive, is that the evidence points in the direction of the historical narrative of God revealing himself to the Jewish people at Har Sinai, and everything flows from there. Rabbi Lawrence Kellerman teaches, I think, at Torah also, a very, very similar type of book. And if you've ever gone to their discovery seminars, also, the point is to show you evidence that the Torah is true. All that is fine. All that is dandy. I'm not going to rebuff it. It is an approach that is out there. Some people find it very convincing. Some people find it less convincing. But it is one of the approaches that's out there today in the Orthodox Jewish community. Another approach, which is, again, complementary, not mutually exclusive, was developed partially in an article written by Rabbi Dr. Aaron Lichtenstein. It could be... If Rabbi Judah Goldberg has gone, he's giving a shiur on the thought of Lichtenstein. Has he done the essay "The Source of Faith is Faith Itself"? Yeah. Oh, so you guys know it already. Some of you guys know it already. So he takes a very same exact question. It takes it in a very different direction, at least in the main part of the essay. So most of Lichtenstein's essays are very long, very very wordy, very sophisticated, very analytical. Over here, he was just asked a question. I forgot by whom, by which organization. Basically, why do you believe in Torah? So instead of Lichtenstein analyzing a sugya, this is more a bedrock in terms of why you believe in Torah, why do you believe in the system and system as a whole. So he starts off by saying this is a very personal question. So he's not sure if his answer is going to resonate with anybody else. He's not sure if his answer is going to be meaningful to anybody else. But it's a personal question, and therefore he can only give a personal answer. He basically divides the essay into three parts, points to three distinct reasons, ideas, concepts, things in his life that lead him on this path to having full conviction in Torah and mitzvahs. The first two things we're going to look at quickly, because they're not so relevant for our points, but let's just look at them, is the source number 2. I refer, of course, does anybody want to read? Please, thank you. Right, the first thing is that he just says that's the way he was raised. And he was raised not just in a firm environment, he was raised where he thinks surrounded by Gedolim, surrounded by super spiritual people, surrounded by people who felt God, seemed to spiritually connect to God, had this level of experience, and also lived exemplary lives. And lives that he thinks were only possible because they were in touch with the divine, they were in touch with God. But again, not everybody is raised by such tzaddikim. Not everybody is zocha. Not everybody is zocha to be in the presence of such Gedolei Yisrael. Recently, I was listening to a lecture also by a non-Orthodox person, Rabbi Zalman Shachter Shalomi. He's a founder of the Jewish Renaissance Movement, a little bit more of like a hippie-ish, less halachically observant form of Judaism. So he passed away a couple years ago. He was born pre-war of Vienna. He grew up in pre-war of Vienna, sort of rebelled against the orthodoxy of his youth, and he came back to Hasidus and eventually left Hasidus. He was a Chabadnik for a while and started his own spiritual thing. So somebody was interviewing him about why he sort of came back or became more serious about Judaism in his youth. He said, I met the Sixth Lubavitch Rebbe and the Friedrich Rebbe, that's what they call him, the Josephus Sixth Nursen. And he said to see him daven was to see somebody communing with God. And that experience of seeing the Sixth Lubavitch Rebbe daven, something that sort of convinced him, not, again, not objectively, rationally, logically, but sort of to put him back on this path towards spirituality, towards reconnecting. It happens if you're in the presence of somebody who seems to be in the presence of God, it does have an effect on us. So that's reason one. Reason two, let's look at source number three for a second. That faith has persistently been reinforced. Who wants to read? Somebody else want to read? Shana, please. Thanks.
That faith has been persistently reinforced by Jewish history, and this in two respects. First, I have envisioned providence as revealed and refracted through its uniqueness in the spirit of the response Chazal ascribed to the Anshei Knesset HaGdolah. These are his awesome effects, for were it not for all of God, how could one nation survive among the nations? Of course, I realize that from a purely logical standpoint, one could rejoin with an analog to Newman's statement that he saw design in nature because he believed in God, not vice versa. But given the substratum of faith, our singular history has provided much reinforcement.
Right, so what's the second thing Rabbi Kolstein finds too, in addition to his parents, his teachers, the people who influenced him in his youth? Jewish history. Right, same thing as Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb. Jewish history is unique. Jewish history reinforces what it actually says in the Torah, that Am Yisrael has a special relationship with Hashem. There's Agav, out of all the reasons to believe in God, and all the reasons to believe in the fact that Hashem revealed himself at Har Sinai, this one in particular is a modern reason. The Rishonim, by and large, as far as I'm aware of these, don't point to the existence of Am Yisrael, to Jewish history, as a reason to believe. Why not? Anybody want to guess? I'm guessing now, but I... If you're living in the 1100s and the 1200s, and you're trying to prove, write a book, explain why you believe in Judaism, so why would pointing to Jewish history not necessarily be the most compelling thing?
Because
Am Yisrael was exactly. Am Yisrael was persecuted. If anything, it's a counter-historical narrative. The Christians pointed to the fact that the Jews were downtrodden as proof that the Jews were being punished for rejecting the Savior. If you're living as a persecuted minority in the Middle Ages, Jewish history is not necessarily going to be the most compelling thing to point to try to build up your case. You're going to point to other things, mass revelation and other things of that sort. But today, in the 20th century, in the post-Holocaust 20th century, in the State of Israel 20th century, all of a sudden, people start looking at Jewish history as this really unique, amazing thing, item, concept, whatever it is, that really seems to underscore the truth of the Torah's narrative. Rabbi Lichtenstein does it. People from Eishes Torah do it. Rabbi Sachs tends to do it a lot. Because Jewish history in the second half of the 20th century, Jews had done something that no other nation has done in the history of the world, which is be in exile for 2,000 years, come back, and rebuild up a state in its own ancestral homeland, which is exactly what the Chumash and Navi predicts. So these types of reasons are things which are more, which as we're reading them, if you realize they're more modern. They're things which we point to. You're not necessarily going to find them in the same way in earlier sources. Which makes sense. Meaning, if Rabbi Yehuda Levi calls his book A Defense of the Persecuted Religion, you're not going to point to the existence of Am Yisrael as a persecuted entity as a compelling proof for Am Yisrael's status as the Am HaNivchar. What I really wanted to get to, though, focus on, is Wolkenstein's third reason, which he says for him is the greatest one. So let's turn the page. Page 4, source number 4. Does somebody else want to read? Not accurate. Please, thank you.
The greatest source of faith, however, has been the Rabbeinu Shlomo Zalman himself. At the level of rational demonstration, this is, of course, patently a secular. I hope no brief for Anselm's ontological proof, and I recognize the theoretical possibility of self-delusion long before I had ever heard of Fauber. Existentially, however, nothing has been more authentic than the encounter with Albino Marquino, the source and ground of all being. Nothing more sustaining, nothing more strengthening, nothing more vivifying. Encounter, of course, has been varied. In part, it has been channeled primarily through Talmud Torah. There is no doubt an aspect of Ma'ar Sheva, the light within it, of which Chazal spoke, but also through Tefillah and the performance of Mitzvah, or if you will, by the halakhic regimen of in its totality. In part, it has been random. Moments of illumination were getting on a crowded bus or watching children play in a park at twilight. Obviously, it has also been greatly varied in intensity. In its totality, however, whatever the form and content, it has been the ultimate basis of spiritual life.
So how would you summarize what Rabbi Lichtenstein is saying over here? What is the ultimate basis of his spiritual life?
Experiential.
Experiential. Which means what? Let's just flesh that out a little bit in English.
It feels like he's seeing God, like in his experience.
Right. It just feels like he feels connected to something transcendent. You feel one way when you're walking down the street. You feel one way when you're just doing your job. And when you're engaged in Torah activities, you're engaged in religion, sometimes even when you're not engaged in religion, you're just watching your kids play in the park, you're watching people in Yerushalayim get onto a bus, there's something strikes you, something hits you, you feel different, you feel like you're connecting to something transcendent, you feel like you're experiencing what's called spirituality, which is the ability to connect to something that seems to be beyond the material, seems to be beyond the material world. So that's why this name of the essay is The Source of Faith is Faith Itself. The very experience of faith is something that gives you strength to continue having faith and buying into the system and living your life by the system. And for people like Lichtenstein, who certainly had other avenues open in front of him, for dedicating all of his strengths to Torah and mitzvos. One point, and then I want to ask a couple of questions. One second. All right. One point is that one reason why I think this essay was important, at least for me when I first read it, is that, again, I can't speak for everybody, but I think a lot of people have these moments or points or experiences in their life at some point along the timeline. Some people more intensely than others, some people more frequently than others, but I think almost everybody who grows up in a religious household has these moments of what you call illumination, of experience, of spirituality, whatever it is. I think what the chiddush in this article is that those moments, those experiences, aren't just things which are powerful for the moment, and then you go back to studying a text, and then you go back to keeping mitzvot, then you go back to doing whatever you're doing in a more rational way. But those experiences are super important, and could be super important in one's religious life if they experience them and think about them and contextualize them in the right way. It's not like you have one powerful Kabbalah Shabbos, one powerful davening of the Kotel, one powerful act of chesed, and then you have to go back to the grind. Those things become sort of the bedrock foundation. You're taking those experiences and thinking about them and realizing how powerful they were. Those things could really become the bedrock foundation of conviction over and above any level of objective truth objective proof or evidence or anything of that sort. Let me ask you a question. Do you find this compelling? Yes. Why? I guess it's just two. If somebody didn't find it compelling, what would you say? Here, Miriam.
I find it hard to accept this, like to say to someone that is questioning Judaism.
Great.
Because if you say that it's all experiential, then you should say that you should experience all the religions and see if you find spirituality in them.
Exactly. Or, Rif and Miriam, read the next line, please. So obviously.
This will obviously provide little guidance for those to whom attaining encounter is precisely the problem.
Let's say you just don't have religious experiences. You don't recognize the fact you have religious experiences. Or you think all your religious experiences are just chemicals, you know, flowing in your brain, which we'll get to in a second. So there's a reason why Rabbi Dr. David Gottlieb is part of a Kiruv organization, and Rav Lichtenstein is not. Because if you think you could objectively prove, or the main method you should be going about to determine that the Orthodox Jewish narrative is the correct narrative for yourself, is weighing the evidence, and you're convinced the evidence is in your favor, That's something you could share with others. Yes, there's an experiential element, and there's the beauty of Shabbos, and the beauty of Tefillah, and the beauty of Chesed, and the types of communities that Halachic Judaism fosters. All that is true. But at the core, you could give a shiur, give a lecture, write a book about the evidence, and which is exactly what they do, exactly what they did. For Filkenstein, it's much trickier. That's why he says at the beginning of the essay, it's very personal. He read mitz. He grew up in an Orthodox household. He experienced Gedolei Yisrael as a young person. His parents were tzaddikim. Whatever it is, he has these experiences within the context of an Orthodox Jewish life, and that's what gives him conviction that he should be living his life according to the Orthodox Jewish narrative that God gave us the Torah a couple thousand years ago on Har Sinai. If you're talking to somebody who doesn't have those experiences, or who has those experiences in a different setting, so then it's very hard to have a conversation with them, try to convince them to lead an Orthodox lifestyle, which is maybe for the other reasons the Rav Filkenstein never started a Kiruv movement, but it makes sense that if that's what Rav Filkenstein says, this will provide little guidance for other people. But you ask me personally, why do I believe? And this is my personal answer, which might resonate with other people, and may not resonate with other people. But let's go on one step. Let's say somebody does say they experience this in other settings. What types of other settings might people experience have these types of experiences?
Meditation
or other religions, which is exactly why, if you read Filkenstein's writings, he's not about to negate the ability for other ideologies, other lifestyles to tap into some form of what he and Rav Soloveitchik, who he's getting this from, call the absolute. Maybe Christians do experience God in some way. Maybe when people meditate, they do tap into some type of spiritual force that can't be pointed to in a laboratory or disclosed in any purely materialistic fashion. But just because there are many ways of tapping into the same divine being doesn't mean they're all equal, which is what Rav Soloveitchik spends a lot of time doing, saying, yeah, it could be Christians do tap into the absolute. They do have true prayer experiences. But let me explain to you why the Orthodox Jewish lifestyle is the best way to have those experiences. It's the best way to live your life. And if you go through his writing, that's sort of exactly what he does. It's sort of like not a defense, but an expression of the way an Orthodox Jewish person lives their life, and the system of halacha, the system of Torah values, and the types of experiences it engenders, and why he thinks it's better than the alternatives. But you sort of have to admit that other people might have these experiences also, and then you have to deal with the fact that maybe not that their narratives are true, but there are multiple ways, if not all equal, but there are other ways of tapping into spirituality, of tapping into the absolute. As opposed to if you're a purely rationalist, you know, evidence-based person, so there's truth and there's not truth. There's like either you're, what the Rambam says, either you're worshiping God or you're worshiping a figment of your imagination, in which case everything you're doing is basically worthless. This is what the Rambam says about pagans, about Avodah Zarah. I mean, this really goes back to the Rishonim. The Rabban says there are spiritual forces behind Avodah Zarah. People had real experiences when they were worshiping Avodah Zarah, but there's just negative forces, negative experiences, so to speak. And the Rambam says no. Rambam says, like, whatever they were doing, they were really just worshiping figments of their own imagination. What they were doing was totally within their own head, totally not correlating to anything real that actually exists out there. So that's just an interesting ramification of this type of approach. One more question. Educational institutions. What types of things should educational institutions be focusing on? If you are a more rational person, and everything should be evidence-based, so if you wanted to create a Jewish philosophy class, a Jewish makshava class, something beyond regular Gemara, Chumash, Halacha, whatever it is, what types of things should you be teaching in Jewish philosophy? No, teach Jewish philosophy, teach text, teach ideas, and let people evaluate the ideas. I'm not saying Rav Filkenstein did this, but if you like this Rav Filkenstein approach, this experiential approach, and you wanted to have a part of your curriculum focused on not Gemara, not Halacha, not Chumash, not Nach, but Jewish philosophy, these types of ideas, what types of ideas, what types of texts, what types of things would you want to put into the curriculum? Things that are meaningful to people. Things that engender experience. Things that are conducive to connection. Maybe books of Hasidus. Maybe books of written by more modern people. Maybe books written in English. Things that engender this type of connection, this type of experience, things that speak to you more, because ultimately that is going to be the bedrock of that is going to be the bedrock of your religious life. Does anybody have the remote control? Is there another air conditioner? I think it's gonna be very hot in here. If not, we'll be done in five minutes, hopefully. Since my book wrote this in an essay, I think in the 1990s. Are you guys familiar with the book Mevakshi Panacha? Is that on the back? Mevakshi Panacha is basically of Chaim Sabato, who is a Rashiva, a founder of Yeshivat Hester Malei Adumim, who has also won Israeli national prizes for literature. He's written several books, not like religious prizes, but national prizes for Israeli literature. He interviewed Rav Lichtenstein about a series of issues, and he made those interviews into a book. He's Israeli, and he sort of pushes Rav Lichtenstein into like define his shittos a little bit more precisely than using a lot. Than sometimes you could hide behind using lots of words. So in the first chapter of this book, Rav Sabato interviews Rav Lichtenstein basically about this point, about this essay, source of faith itself, and other similar things Rav Lichtenstein said. So look at source number 4, and then the numbers are messed up. Look at page 5, the top source in Hebrew. So this is Rav Sabato talking. Harav medaber kan atuchoshot pnimiot. You, Rav Lichtenstein, are speaking about inner feelings. Ha'im rashai ha'adam esmoch atuchoshotav shen emanotein. Could you really rely on your feelings that they're reliable, that they're truthful? Maybe I can experience God when I'm staring at a beach. Maybe I experience a religious high when I'm watching the Super Bowl, if it's an overtime. Maybe I get that type of feeling at a symphony concert, or at a rock concert, or a pop concert, or something of that sort. People get these experiences in all sorts of environments. Who is to say that I could trust my experiences at a davening, of chesed, of Torah learning, as opposed to anything else? So, just on that point, Rav Soloveitchik has a line in one of his essays where he says, the religious experience is very hard to differentiate from the aesthetic experience. Meaning, basically pointing this out, that sometimes an aesthetic experience, going to an art museum, a symphony concert, a good sports game if you're into sports, also gives you a certain rush. And it's hard sometimes to differentiate between that and a true religious experience where you're something deeper, more existential, where you're experiencing God. So Rav Lichtenstein responded as follows. A person could suspect that their feelings, their experiences, are imaginary or illusory. Well before I heard about Feuerbach, Feuerbach is a guy he quoted in the essay also. Feuerbach was if I recall correctly, an 1800s writer who basically wrote against Christianity. And he wrote about the reason why we had this entire history of Christian religious experiences is because the Christian mystics tend to write about their experiences much more than Jewish mystics. Kabbalists tend to not write so much about their own experiences. Other religions, other mystical traditions, people wrote a lot more. You have a lot of texts of Christian mystics describing their religious experiences. The reason why that exists is basically because they were imagining it. It was hallucinatory, illusory. They thought they were tapping into something, so they ended up experiencing or feeling certain things, but didn't conform to anything real. So Rav Lichtenstein says, well, before I heard about Feuerbach, I realized you could suspect the authenticity of your own experiences. But I live with a feeling that from my perspective, my connection to God is more reliable and more true and more real than anything else I can think about. Descartes amar lanu, ani choshev mashmash ani kayam. So Descartes said, I think therefore I am. Od harbe yoter mitkushat hakiyum, well before my thoughts about existence, ani margish ani mamin. I feel that I'm a believer. Ani chash kirva lekadosh baruch hu yoter mikol davar acher. I feel close to God more than to anything else in the world. Emet, it's true. Mibichina a priori teoretit, from an a priori theoretical perspective, if you step outside of yourself and think about, analyze yourself, we know it's possible the person could fool themselves if it's uncomfortable for them. Avo in Cain, but if I would step outside of myself and I would think that about myself, I would have to negate myself in order to negate, I would have to erase myself in order to negate my religious experiences. I'm not prepared to do this, I think it's not a true approach. What's Rav Lichtenstein basically saying? That sometimes we just have to trust the authenticity of our own experiences. Or this is something he's saying about himself. He trusts the authenticity of his own experiences. It might be neuroscientists who could trace his experiences to different types of chemicals that are flowing around in the brain. And there might be psychologists or sociologists or historians who could trace his experiences to the development of religion over time or whatever it is. But if Eccleston says, if he would believe or if he would suspect that his experiences weren't real, he would have to take away part of himself. He would have to take away the same way, there's no objective evidence that our parents love us, no objective evidence that anybody likes us, no objective evidence to any of this stuff. But we believe it. We live life with those assumptions because that's the way we experience reality. When I see that analogy in a second, the same thing is true for faith according to Rav Lichtenstein. If we would take that away, take away those powerful moments in our lives, we would be left with the shell of ourselves, and therefore we have the right, we have the ability. He says, I made the judgment call to believe the authenticity of my own experiences. He's describing very powerful religious experiences over here. A couple pages later, he just points out, look at the next source, this is page 22, two pages later. I can't say I experience this amazing feeling at every moment. But I believe that true believers do experience these things from time to time. Times, experiences, moments from which you derive, from which you're able to suck, to draw out deep experiences. Experiences that put their seal, put their stamp on every strand of the person's soul. A person's entire personality is going to be built from them. Good. So that's where I was about to pushing Rav Lichtenstein. Do you really trust yourself? Maybe it's all illusory. Maybe it's all hallucinatory. Maybe it's all delusional. Rav Lichtenstein says, it's possible. I thought about the possibility. You can't deny that. But sometimes things are so deep and so profound, and you just experience them in such a way that to erase them, to think that it's hallucinatory, would just be to erase part. It would be to erase part of yourself. If you turn the page, maybe I'll spend two more minutes on this. Rav Soloveitchik describes this approach in various essays. If you ever read his essay, it will be Kash Misham. There you shall seek. In the beginning, he points out that this was not the approach as explicitly of medieval Jewish philosophers. Medieval Jewish philosophers tried to rationally prove God's existence and rationally prove the Torah's narrative that God gave the Torah to the Jewish people. Rav Soloveitchik, for various reasons, doesn't think that is the correct approach in general or the correct approach, particularly in modern times, and he goes to the more experiential approach. I mean, he thinks the proofs are there, they're important, but the bedrock foundation has to be the experience. This is a footnote in Lonely Man of Faith. If you guys were in Mrs. Brodsky's Rabbi Berzon's class, you probably encountered this at some point, but let's read it together. Who wants to read? There's a loving bride. Please, Jacqueline.
Does the loving bride in the embrace of her beloved ask for proof that he is alive and real? Must the prayerful soul, clinging in passionate love and ecstasy to her beloved, demonstrate that he exists? So asked Soren Kierkegaard sarcastically when told that the Anselm of Canterbury, the father of the very abstract and complex ontological proof, spent many days in prayer and supplication that he be presented with rational evidence of the existence of God.
Right, Anselm of Canterbury was, I think, a 12th century monk. Somebody could check it off in their phones if they have internet down here. Who came up? There are four basic medieval proofs in the philosophical world for the existence of God. A lot of Jewish, but four proofs that were there in the medieval world. One of them was founded by Anselm of Canterbury, who was a monk. And the story goes that he fasted for 3 days on his knees, praying that God should reveal to him a proof that God exists. And at the end, he came up with this very, very complex ontological proof, one that is a Wikipedia page on it. It's very hard to parse it from a modern perspective. It's based on all these like sort of medieval assumptions. And Soren Kierkegaard, who was not a Jewish person, he was a Christian theologian living in the 1800s, early 1900s, that Rav Soloveitchik happened to like, writes in his own journal that when he read the story about Anselm of Canterbury, he laughed. Why did he laugh? Because if you're already so faithful, you're fasting for 3 days, and you're praying, and you have a real experience of God, asking God to reveal a proof to you, why do you need a proof? What's the point of it at the end? So obviously, if Soloveitchik says, it's good to have proofs in the end. We don't want our faith to be irrational. We don't want our faith to not make any sense. We want to be able to trace things back to have things logically aligned in our mind. But the point that he's quoting approvingly from Kierkegaard is that what is the bedrock for the, what's the chicken and what's the egg? What's the bedrock foundation and what is something built upon that? The bedrock foundation is that experience of being on your knees, if you're a Christian, in front of God, praying and fasting and communicating with God. The icing on the cake is the proof at the end. Good. What's interesting about this is that by Rav Soloveitchik and Rav Lichtenstein taking this approach, they're almost embracing a Hasidish model of emunah. Hasidim, they speak about emunah in various ways. I don't have any text over here. Something that's innate, something that's natural, but they talk about religious experience, experiencing God, the innate emunah, the innate ava meira that's in the neshama of a Jew, to a lesser degree in the neshama of all human beings, as something that naturally connects them to God, as opposed to faith being something which you have to learn and convince yourself of based on outside proofs. The one story that sort of gets this point across is it's sort of out of context, but Rabbi Nachman's story about the Hungarian wine. Anybody familiar with it? The Hungarian wine? So it's one of Rabbi Nachman's mashals. Rabbi Nachman made up stories. This, I think, he said he heard from somebody else and he applied it to this. So the story, goes as follows. Back in Europe, there was a rich person, and he had a wagon driver. And wherever they would go, they would go into businesses in different cities. Whenever they got to the inn, the rich business person would go to the fancy bar. And the wagon driver would go to the local tavern to drink some beer, and the rich business person would go to the fancy bar to drink Hungarian wine. Hungarian wine was the fanciest wine at the time. Is that really true? I don't know, but that's what throughout Rabbi Nachman's story is. The Hungarian wine is like considered the best type of wine. And so they continued for years. At one point, the rich business person told the Baal HaGalah, so told his wagon driver, you know, you've been a loyal person, you've been a loyal worker, employee for years already, I'm going to sponsor you a drink. When next city we go to, instead of going to the local tavern, come to the fancy restaurant, fancy bar with me, I'll sponsor you a bottle of Hungarian wine. The person goes ahead, he walks into the bar, he's dressed in dirty workday clothing, he's out of place. The guy asks for two bottles of Hungarian wine. He personally pours the person, his wagon driver, Hungarian wine. The person lifts it up, makes a bracha, he drinks. The Tamagan Eden. Mamish, the best wine he's ever tasted. Good. The next day, or years later, I forgot exactly how the story goes, they're continuing on their travels, and the wagon driver and the business person end up in different bars, different restaurants, different places to drink alcohol as they were. In this particular town, there were a bunch of people who were in the local tavern and local pub with the wagon driver who wanted to play a trick on him. And they said, you know, you could either order regular beer like you always do, but if you want, we actually have an extra bottle of Hungarian wine. The guy got really excited. Hungarian wine, it was the best taste he ever tasted, whatever it was. They take out a bottle, very fancy, they pour him a cup, he tastes it, he sips it. Says it's not Hungarian wine. I say, no, look at the label, it's there, it's true, you could trace it back, all the information is here. It's like, it's not Hungarian wine. And they admit that it wasn't Hungarian wine. They ask him how he knew. He said, I once tasted real, authentic Hungarian wine. And that taste is still in my mouth. That Tom of Gan Eden. And now I can't be fooled by less authentic types of wine that are being advertised as Hungarian wine. In the original Mashal of Rabbi Nachman, it's sort of a different distinction between Breslov Torah and other types of Torah. That Breslov Torah is like Hungarian wine, and everything else. And once you hit Rabbi Nachman's Torah, you realize what authentic on fire Torah is, and everything else is not everything else, but certain other types of Torah are made to be a little bit lesser. But I've seen this mashal being used as a mashal for faith in general along the lines of this experiential approach. It's not like this wagon driver drank Hungarian wine on a constant basis. It's not like every day he drank Hungarian wine. If you really taste something as it tastes like on Eden, you only need one or two of those things in your life, and that taste is able to continue with you such that you're not going to be fooled by other things that are marketed as Hungarian wine, and you're able to take that taste with you in your mouth all the way for the rest of your life. So I apologize if I broached a large topic in 54 minutes, only doing the two approaches. There are other approaches out there. Generally speaking, these types of topics are much easier to discuss in smaller settings and more conversation-based. But I guess I hope at least these two approaches are able to be two general guidelines for us as we go forward in terms of our learning and our growth and our Buddhist Dharma in general. And if you want to continue the conversation, there are other things to read, other things to think about, and I would love to continue the conversation. Hope everybody has a great vacation.